and welcome. You're listening to Real Food, Real Life. Today is April 11th, 2011, and I'm your host, Christina Petit, registered dietitian of Eating the Good Life with ChristinaPetit.com. And with me today is my co-host, as always, Jerrica Cadman, a food activist and owner of ShadyGroveRanch.net and TrueFields.com. Today we are talking about Weston A. Price and who he was, his life's work in nutrition, and what it means to us today. But first, let's get started with a little bit of news. Jerrica, do you have some news to share with us?
Well, I had done a little reading just at random this morning about baby food. We actually did a baby food podcast last month, and it's too bad I didn't see it before that, but it just came out. But what they had done is some studies over in the UK of some common brands of baby food, and they found higher levels of heavy metals than they had expected, like arsenic and cadmium and lead. Tainting the baby foods. They were, I forget the quantities. It's still pretty small levels, and it's still lower than the quote unquote acceptable level according to the FDA. But the article was basically saying, we're concerned because this would certainly not be good for an infant younger than 6 months, just because their bodies are so small, and they're growing so rapidly that heavy metals have a very detrimental effect, more so than in adults. But anyway, so they kind of had tested some different brands, and some of the brands, were like, oh well, we're gonna try to put some things in place to make sure that these levels stay low. And apparently, it happens when crops pick up heavy metals from the soil. So anyway, this study basically was saying, watch out for some of these brands. And what was interesting to me was, I thought, well, maybe it's arsenic in conventional pesticides, because they tend to be high in heavy metals, and the plants then absorb the heavy metals out of the soil. But actually, some of the certified organic brands were also high in things like arsenic, the rice cereal and the brown rice cereal and different things that they are selling for baby food. So it was a little scary, and I guess our suggestion would probably just be make your own baby food out of food that you're buying from good organic local operations, that you can ask them, okay, what kinds of pesticides are you using in your soil? Because even some of these certified organic pesticides can still be very toxic, and I would venture to even guess, some of them might contain some heavy metals. So
yeah,
you just never know. Watch out what you're feeding your baby.
Now, did they mention brands?
They did. I think it was probably more brands more common in UK, but some of them were like Nestle has a couple of lines of baby food. And then there was one called Organics, and there were a couple of others that I had never heard of, but I don't really ever buy baby food, so I have no idea what the brands are. I know Gerber, but the Gerber wasn't on the list, but I don't know if they sell Gerber in the UK, so but it was interesting.
That is interesting. Well, more than likely, if they did a study in the UK, they'll probably want to do a study in the U.S. pretty soon.
Things usually happen over there before they happen over here, but they eventually happen over here, too.
Yeah, they'll probably study it here next. Well, I was just reading yesterday about a new study done by an epidemiologist at the University of Miami Miller School of Medicine. And what they did is they evaluated about 2,500 New Yorkers and found out that the New Yorkers that drank soda every day, diet soda, every day had a 61% higher risk for vascular events like stroke and heart attack. And they accounted for risk factors like obesity and high blood pressure and things like that, and still found that soda drinkers had a 61% higher risk for vascular events.
And that's diet soda.
That's diet soda, yeah. Thank you. Yes, diet soda. But the researcher said, but, soda may not be the villain, because they may be eating it with Big Mac and fries, and of course no part of that equation is good, so they also noted in this article is from MSNBC, that there have been several animal studies that show that the actual caramel coloring is linked to vascular problems as well, and has had negative effects in animal studies of causing vascular problems. And
do you remember when they came out with that white Pepsi?
Clear about
Pepsi
that.
Years
yes.
ago. I remember how it was all the rage, because it was clear.
Yes.
Whatever. I don't know. It was strange.
Yeah, I do remember that. I forgot about that. But the researchers do say that, it's a small study, and we need a larger study before you know, you shouldn't make any decisions about your soda drinking, but you know, it may be a small study on the vascular effects of drinking diet soda, but there are plenty of larger studies to prove the negative effects of soda that I don't see any rationalization of keeping it in the diet because this is a small soda or because it hasn't specifically proved multiple times to cause vascular problems. Mm-hmm. It's
in response to the you know, aspartame and the high fructose corn syrups, you know, concern in the public, these a lot of these major soda manufacturers have come up with what they're calling, I think, a throwback line of soda, where they sweeten them now with real sugar, and you can actually pay extra to have just real sugar in your soda, 30 grams per serving. So there you go. Yeah, I thought it was pretty funny because it's Mountain. I saw it at Walmart the other day. I saw, you know, they had these special, like, retro-looking labels, and there was Mountain Dew and Pepsi, and, of course, Dr. Pepper's been doing it for a while.
I'm sure they'll come out with agave nectar one, too.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, you can already get those at the health food store, but they're still...
Which is still
a handful
refined
of sugar.
Yes, and actually, I have heard about agave sugar, not to divert, you know, get off topic, but agave nectar, the kind you can buy in the store, now there is a traditional version of agave nectar, but it tastes very different. It tastes a lot stronger than what you can buy at the store. But the agave nectar is touted as, oh, well, it, you know, it's low glycemic index, and it's, you know, it doesn't affect your blood sugar levels and blah, blah, blah. It's actually very similar to high fructose corn syrup.
It's processed the exact same way.
Yeah, it's produced the exact same way. They just use agave instead of corn.
Yes.
So there you go.
Yes. And we could go, oh, that's a good subject, too.
Yeah, that would be an interesting one.
Health food
I get questions
busts,
about that a
you
lot.
Know,
yeah.
Let's bust some
what
of those
What about agave?
Foods?
It's so good for you. No, it's pretty much high fructose corn syrup in a healthy bottle. So there you go.
With good marketing. High fructose corn syrup with good marketing.
That's right.
Yes. Well, someone reviewing this article, I can't pronounce their name, but they're the director of inflammatory risk cardiology at the University of Pennsylvania, noted with this study, they said that, you know, unless you have a lot of cardiac risk factors, you probably don't want to give up your diet soda at this time until a larger study is done. And
if you're at risk for heart disease, go back to drinking regular sugary soda instead of chemical soda.
Well, and, you know, let's just think about this. Unless you're at risk for cardiac disease, you don't want to give up your diet soda. Well, first of all, most of America is overweight and obese, mm-hmm. so that's a lot of portion of our population that is at risk for heart mm-hmm. disease. And second of all, what's the benefit of diet soda? I mean, it's been disproved many times that it does mm-hmm. not aid in weight loss at any...
Mm-hmm. I've actually seen some studies that that people who tend to drink more diet soda actually intend to consume more calories per day
Correct.
Than a regular soda drinker.
Correct.
There's
yes.
something about it. It stimulates appetite or insulin resistance or something. So.
There's several different theories, and the way the body responds to that, the liquid is different, so... Anyway, I just thought that was very interesting, but take it for what it's worth. Let's get on to our topic for today. Let's talk about Weston A. Price. Jerrica is actually the area chapter leader mm-hmm. for part of East Texas, and mm-hmm. so she's just a Weston A. Price expert, so we're going to let her talk about Weston A. Price right now.
Well, we, my husband and I found out about Weston Price Foundation back, probably at least 3 or 4 years ago. We were kind of in the middle of a health crisis for him. He has ulcerative colitis, which basically means his colon is inflamed and full of ulcers. So it's a very bad situation. He's about 6'5" and drops to 120 pounds during a severe flare-up. So he looks like concentration camp refugee. I mean, it's bad. And basically the medical consensus was, well, we'll put you on steroids, we'll put you on antibiotics, and we'll try all these wonder drugs. But if it doesn't work, then we'll just cut your colon out. We were kind of like, he's in his 20s. This is not really an acceptable answer to us. This is not good enough. Something must be able to be done besides just a total colectomy. So we just really started researching it. I actually remember coming home from the hospital every day after visiting him and just looking on the internet for hours and hours and hours trying to find a cure for Crohn's disease or ulcerative colitis, which I really didn't understand the disease very much back then. And I really didn't find any answers at all. But I ended up talking, we met some people, and they invited us to come to a 2-day conference that was going on in the area at that time. And so we went to that, and we heard, for the first time, this revolutionary wisdom about you can eat butter, and you can drink raw milk, and you can eat eggs and meat, and you know, but it should come from pasture-raised animals that are nutrient-dense, and your vegetables and things should be cooked and fermented and prepared well, in addition to being raised well, and also your grains need to be prepared well. So that's kind of the general consensus of the Weston Price knowledge.
Well, let me interrupt and ask you a question. When you first heard, were you floored? Were you surprised?
Oh, yeah. We were like, what? You know, butter is supposed to be horrible for you. What are they talking about? You can drink, you know, you can eat butter. And we just tried all kinds of, we tried raw milk for the first time. We tried kombucha tea for the first time. I remember seeing the mother, quote unquote, and it looks like a giant, I don't know what it looks like. But anyway, we just, you know, it was just so new, but we were like, this makes sense. This, it really fits. And there's a lot of research, and they had a lot of research. And that was what turned us on to it so much, is that, you know, somebody finally had some scientific reason of what to eat and when to eat it and how to eat it. And that was the first time we'd ever really heard that. I mean, a lot of people will try to sell you their supplements or try to sell you their fancy juicing machine and their juice pills and this and that.
Yes.
You know? But it's like, well, give me some knowledge. What were people doing, you know, 500 years ago that didn't have all this equipment and technology? And, you know, they seemed to be healthier. They didn't have high cancer rates and high mortality rates and things. Because if they did, then we probably would have all died off by now. Humanity would have ceased. Anyway, so who Weston Price is, or was, I'm sorry, he's dead now. He practiced, he was a dentist that practiced in Cleveland in the 30s. And he basically was seeing a lot of his patients coming in that had really poor health in addition to having poor dental health. And so he kind of made the correlation, like maybe this has to do something with, you know, their diet or some other factor that we're not taking account for in America. because Americans seem to have such poor health. And at that time, the photojournalism was starting to take off because globalization was beginning. And people were able to travel to remote areas of the world and bring back pictures and journals about people that nobody had ever seen before. And so what he would do is he'd see these pictures in magazines of people with just beautiful pearly white teeth. And they had bones stuck through their nose, you know. I mean, they were like very primitive groups, living in their ancestral diets and their ancestral ways. But they had wide, wide palates. All their teeth fit. They had all their wisdom teeth. They didn't have any crowding. They didn't have any cavities. Apparently, looking at their teeth, and they were just beautiful, beautiful people. So he decided. I think his son died of a brain aneurysm related to an abscess that got infected. So I guess he had a lot of motivation to find out what is it that is making these people healthy when we're so poor in health, even though we have all these civilized foods.
And medical care.
Yeah, and medical care and everything else. And dentists. So he decided to travel the world and observe what is making people healthy or not healthy that have not been tainted by civilization. So he went seriously to every continent where there were people living. He visited Gaelic people groups in North Scotland. He visited mountain people in Switzerland, Polynesian people groups on islands out in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, and Aborigines, New Zealand people, some African tribes. He just went and observed a lot of different people groups. And what he found was that in general, the ones that were still eating their ancestral diets, in other words, they were eating non-refined foods, non-canned foods, nothing weird or processed or manipulated in any way other than just a traditional type of preparation. Those people didn't have the common diseases like tuberculosis at the time or polio, or they didn't even have cavities. It was amazing because he would go into a tribe of people that had like green slime on their teeth, you know, he'd wipe it off and take pictures of their teeth, and he would not find one cavity among 100 people. And they just had phenomenal health. They were very robust. They had lots of children with ease. They didn't have problematic pregnancies or births. And they were just amazingly healthy. And what was really fascinating was people that, you know, he would look at like tribes that had been related at one time. And some of the tribes lived closer to where areas had been civilized. And therefore, you know, things like white flour and refined sugar would be trucked in and be available at stores in the area. And he could actually see a very visible difference in the generations that were raised eating these refined foods versus the generations that kept eating their ancestral foods. And he could actually see an instant, you know, like almost overnight change in the generations of the size of their mouth, their palate, and the ability for all their teeth to fit without crowding. And even just, you know, acquisition of disease. A lot of these tribes that were becoming quote unquote civilized, were mm-hmm. dying of disease that they didn't have inoculations for back then. So really fascinating stuff. And what he basically, he brought a lot of the foods that they were eating back to his laboratory and analyzed them and just kind of, you know, took lots and lots of pictures of their teeth and took extensive notes on what they were eating. And what he found was the common factor, it was not any one particular, you know, amazing magic food. It was actually that they were just eating more nutrients. They were eating about four times as much water-soluble vitamins and minerals, and about 10 times as much fat-soluble nutrients as Americans at the time, back in the 30s, which, of course, it's changed a lot since then. We've had a lot of newfangled foods invented since the 30s. But anyway, that was what Dr. Price found. He has a very extensive and scientific book called Nutrition and Physical Degeneration. It's really long and extremely heavy to read, but it's very fascinating. He has a lot of studies on how he actually cured people in the United States of dental decay by changing their diet. I remember one story especially that stood out was a young girl who had 42 cavities in 24 teeth, and they had recommended just pulling all her teeth and starting over with dentures, basically. But he was able to put her on some high vitamin substances, which we'll talk about, and cured her dental decay. People in the United States don't think of dental decay as something that could be cured. It just has to be cut out and filled in with metal or, you know, composite or whatever. Well, he actually reversed the dental decay. Her dentin grew back, and she only had to have a couple of root canals, just on ones that were especially bad, but the rest of her teeth were saved, the original teeth.
Wow. Was she off all of modern foods?
Yeah, and they took her off of all the white sugar, white flour, and they put her on high vitamin butter oil and cod liver oil, which are extremely high in fat-soluble nutrients, and that was how her situation was reversed. It was just amazing. He has x-rays of her teeth, too. You can see the evidence of new dentin growing in her teeth.
Wow.
Very fascinating.
That is fascinating. Well, I was watching TV the other night. I wrote about this show in my blog a few weeks ago, The Wild Within, and it comes on the Travel Channel. And, you know, I think I wrote on my blog that it comes on HGTV. It comes on the Travel Channel. I just now realized that. Anyway, it's called The Wild Within, and the host, his name is Steve, he travels the world and kind of showcases different hunting cultures, people that still harvest their own food from the wild, and he travels continent to continent, and he was, a couple of weeks ago, he was in South America, and the Amazon, in this remote village where they had no access to modern foods, and they ate their traditional diet that they had eaten for hundreds and hundreds of years. Hmm. And they ate whatever they could kill off the land, fish they could get from the Amazon, and some a local starchy plant, and a few other things. But the first thing I noticed is that his guide on this hunting trip flashed this gorgeous smile to the camera. I mean, here they are living in this dangerous, remote Amazon in a wild place. There are no dentists there. I mean, my goodness, there's nothing. They are there. Those people are there, and that's it. Gorgeous, big, white, straight, bright smile. Mm. And as soon as he smiled, I looked at my husband. Did you see that? Did you see that? Oh, my goodness. And all the people in the village were like that. But so it's good to know that you can still find pockets like that around the world. Mm-hmm. But tell us a little bit about the Weston Price organization today.
Oh, sure. Well, it was founded in the 90s based on his research, and basically the organization is a nonprofit dedicated to educating people about the works of Dr. Price and furthering research in the areas that Price was not able to, you know, he actually, I believe, wanted to, you know, do a lot more analysis of foods, and he actually had identified a compound called Activator X that he wasn't able to really pin down, okay, what is this? And so the foundation wants to eventually build a laboratory where they can identify sources of excellent nutrient-dense foods so that people can have some, you know, education as far as, okay, are we eating something that's really nutrient-dense, or is it just being marketed as, you know, it's healthy, yada, yada.
Yeah.
So that's the foundation is really, they try to keep people abreast of what's happening in legislation so that people have rights to food. In particular, you know, there are things, the raw milk is especially a volatile area. Because there's a lot of states that are hostile to raw milk producers and don't let people sell raw milk at all under any circumstances. And so the foundation's dedicated to letting people have access to a healthy food like that, as well as teaching parents how to prepare for conception, because Price found that actually a lot of these people groups that were extremely healthy and had very robust children, they prepared well in advance before their, you know, before pregnancy, and it was the husband too, would prepare to have children by eating especially nutrient-dense foods, or what they called the sacred foods.
Yes. That's part of his research that I found so interesting.
Mm-hmm. It's so that people could, you know, their bodies could be really in tip-top shape before they even conceived, so that they would have excellent, very, very healthy babies, basically. So that's what the foundation's about. They're really about teaching. They have a very extensive website. They put out a quarterly journal every quarter that has different kinds of articles. They usually have a theme, but most of the time they're pretty diverse. They do a lot of book reviews, and they really just help people get connected to local farmers, local producers of excellent food, and help people sift through the onslaught of information about nutrition out there, because people will tell you all sorts of different things, and this will cure, you know, no matter what it is, it will cure you for sure. So it's really hard, and it's nice to have a very science-based research source for choosing what to eat or not to eat.
It is. just the amount of research out there. I mean, when you hear something, a new study cited on the news or in an article or on the newspaper, or like this MSNBC one that I read earlier. I read another one online this morning. And I don't even know which news group it was, reporting that hot dogs are better for you than chicken. Well, that's a headline that's going to, their job is to sell. That's a headline that's going to sell. Mm-hmm. Well, when you look at it, there are several different carcinogens, which when you test them, are higher in hot dogs than in chicken. But mm-hmm. they found one carcinogen that was actually higher in chicken.
It's probably the arsenic.
No, it wasn't the arsenic. No, it was not. They found one carcinogen that was higher in chicken than hot dogs. But
the question
it was
is,
irrelevant.
Who's hot dogs and who's chicken are they looking at?
Well, and the fact was it's irrelevant because all of the other ones, the cumulative, there's thousands of carcinogens, are higher in hot dogs. So this one that they found was a fluke. Well, they're just wanting to sell papers. That's mm-hmm. going to sell. Mm-hmm. You put a headline like that, people want to read, oh my gosh, my chicken is carcinogenic and my hot dog is not?
Right.
So it's ridiculous. But to get to that point where you see through the truth, you've got to have more than what that newscast is going to tell you. You need to see the article. You need to really see an adequate peer review of that work. Mm-hmm.
You can have almost anything published.
You can.
Just about.
You can. Yeah. But and even if it was a good article that was published, the way the media flips it to sell and to get a big headline mm-hmm. is not going to be always an accurate portrayal of what was found. Mm-hmm. I mean, even if the researcher had good intentions and they portrayed it correctly. So you can't go by what Reader's Digest says and other mm-hmm. things, you know. And sometimes they have a good heart. I'm not saying they're trying to kill you or anything, mm-hmm. but they are trying to sell, and they have to put forth a dramatic mm-hmm. headline that might not best represent the information. So it's good to know a resource where you can really mm-hmm. dive into some research and find out what's truth and what's not mm-hmm. and make some decisions for yourself. Mm-hmm. That's a valuable resource.
Yeah, that's true. Well, you know, and as I said, the journal they publish, it usually has articles about raising children, you know, how to, not raising children, like here's some parenting tips, but, you know, as far as what to feed your kids or what to eat while you're pregnant, or what's really neat about the journal is it's an easy read, but it's also extremely scientific. They usually have very good sources, very strong sources, and doctors as well as lay people can benefit from reading it, just because it's a very well-rounded but also scientific type of resource.
Yes.
We really like it.
Yeah.
And it's got some, you know, it's got some ads at the back, so you can kind of shop around. And it's also got lists of the chapter leaders and their phone numbers and email addresses. So you can actually email a person in your area to find out where can I find food, or can we sit down and talk about how to get us started on, you know, eating a healthier diet. And they're usually there. We volunteer. We don't get paid. You know, we just do this for free. So
that's actually how I met Jerrica. Was mm-hmm. I was giving a teaching a class. Was it before? No. It was before I taught the class. It was mm-hmm. I was giving a talk to.
I think she was looking for a pig. or something?
No. The first time I contacted you, I was right before I spoke to our local MOPS group.
Oh.
And I knew the resources of food providers that I had, mm-hmm. but I thought, I need to contact the local Weston A. Price person because I never have, and because I'm giving this talk. And mm-hmm. remember, that's the first thing I asked you was a resource list, and you were like, I just gave birth. I need to get a list together. Hold on.
Oh, gosh. I since have.
So and you. But I remember I was like right after Chevy was born.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, I contacted Jerrica to have a source of different area providers of which I did end up buying the pig from you, which is very good. But different providers so that I could hand that out to some of the people in the MOPS group. Because I knew the ones that were closest to me that I used, and not all of these women lived near me, and so. Your local chapter leader is a great resource.
Mm-hmm. Our job is to kind of scope out, you know, the various farms and just see, you know, I mean, it's kind of, they let us have a lot of free rein as far as, you know, who we recommend and stuff. Obviously, people who have confined animals or do, like, toxic practices and things, we obviously don't put them on the list. But in general, I try to be pretty lenient about, you know, who I mean, it's up to you. I'm not going to be like the FDA and tell you, well, you can't go to that farm, or I'm not going to tell you about these different sources. You know, as a chapter leader, I'm telling you, okay, here's what I think you should start with. Now, you need to find out if, you know, if these farms really meet your standards or not. It's not, you know, just don't blindly walk in and start eating their vegetables, you know, like, you need to ask some questions. But I do try to screen them. But I give the farmers the benefit of the doubt too, because I don't want to shut them down just because they have a few, you know, things they haven't changed over to more, you know, quote unquote organic or whatever. But anyway, the chapter leaders are an excellent resource just in terms of getting started eating real food and where to find the real food as well.
Definitely, definitely. And there's so much you can read out there. I wanted to note there are several other people who did work like this. I think Weston A. Price probably made it his life work, whereas a lot of these other doctors were missionaries who went to foreign places mm-hmm. to set up hospitals and noticed this, the same thing that Weston A. Price did. And usually most of them were missionaries, and so they spent their life abroad and so did not actually come home and try to start a food revolution as much as he did, perhaps.
They weren't really researchers.
They did. A lot of them did end up doing research and get into it, but they weren't. They were staying there. I mean, some people stayed there their whole lives mm-hmm. far away. And so, anyway, one of the first ones was a French physician. I can't pronounce his name. It's Stanislas, and his last name is Tanchou, and who worked for Napoleon. And, mm-hmm. He was a physician, worked for Napoleon, but ended up specializing in cancer and started to notice that in France and in all of Europe that cancer was becoming rampant. Mm. But he noticed it was only in the cities and not the rural areas where people were still eating what was around them, eating traditional foods, mm-hmm. eating meats, eggs, and didn't have access yet to the ground flour and the mm-hmm. sugar, which, by the way, we like to think that that became popular in the 50s, but it was really more mid-1800s that it became cheap to do the white sugar mm-hmm. and the ground white flour. Mm-hmm. The mill was improved to the point, the actual mechanism of the mill itself went through an upgrade at that time, and mm-hmm. that's when it became very prevalent. It wasn't just the wealthy that had it. Then it became the poor man's mm-hmm. food, as it is today, the white. That's something, once, like we've talked about in another podcast, once you take all the nutrients away, it becomes a product that can sit on a shelf forever. Rats don't want to eat it because you've processed that flour to death and there's nothing nutritious in it. And so it was great for the poor population mm-hmm. or for sailors or to ship off to far places because it lasted. But anyway, this guy started studying and did tons of research and realized that in rural areas, they had no gastric ulcers, no colitis, appendicitis, and no cancer. And so they have doctors that aren't just coming in going, oh, yeah, y'all look healthy. so this population is good and that's not. And then the in town where they have all the doctors mm-hmm. is not healthy. And some people start thinking, well, they didn't really evaluate them. Or there weren't diagnostic mm-hmm. methods in those rural areas. That's one of the
Or they'll, you know, they'll say, well, maybe all the, you know, all the sick ones died really early, so the ones that survived were really healthy or something. I don't
right.
know. There's all kinds of silly arguments.
There's, I mean, there's more than 15 different guys like this mm-hmm. who've studied this, who've studied different cultures. And, like I said, some of them are living in these populations for 40 years. They are the doctor. They, and they are not seeing any cancer. There are, I'll just list some of the names and then give you, and instead of, putting links to all their stuff, you all can just Google them at home. And then I'll give you a gist of their information. The early 1900s, Albert Schweitzer was in, West Africa. Samuel Hutton did the Eskimos. I'm sure a lot of y'all have heard about him. Let's see. In the early 1900s, Alice Herdlicka, I don't know how you say that one. Early 1900s, W. Roger Williams. Let's see. George Campbell, South Africa, he did a lot of work. Basically, all of these people studied populations for long periods of time. They didn't pop their head in and say, oh yeah, they all look good, the ones that are alive. It was people, these were people whose life work was studying these populations. We're talking about the Eskimos, places in the Polynesian, the various parts of Africa, several different parts of Africa, India, Native Americans, lots of research on the Native Americans mm-hmm. before they started getting rations from us that were sugar and flour, mm-hmm. what they have now. And the Native American population is just it's a very sad mm-hmm. case of our own mistake because we took away their land and then mm-hmm. gave them white flour and sugar, and now their the obesity, mm-hmm. diabetes, and kidney failure are rampant. But in the early 1900s, they were studied extensively mm-hmm. for their lack of disease. And they were, those still living a traditional diet that started out by several different doctors who were from the government to take care of the Native American population. They were government doctors assigned to Native Americans.
Wow.
They were in awe. There was no, none of the civilized disease, appendicitis, colitis, pancreatitis, mm-hmm. no cancer. And, of course, no diabetes and heart disease and then the other common chronic mm-hmm. diseases. They evaluated what they ate. And it's the same thing with all the other areas that we're talking about. There were no modern foods. There was no refined white flour, and there was no sugar, and it was just nutrient-dense foods. One thing they all have in common is typically they are high in fat, high in protein, mm-hmm. They eat whatever vegetables are around them. Sometimes they'll eat some starchy vegetable, too, that they will take great pains into making some type of a bread product. Mm-hmm. But it's not... not like us that we would go and buy Mrs. Baird. You know, it takes them great pains to get this random thing we've never heard of, this food item mm-hmm. we've never heard of, into a carbohydrate state. But anyway, so all of these people studied these different areas for their whole life. And mm-hmm. so they're living out there treating these people for 40 years. And in rural areas, especially in like Africa, what they were treating was more like dysentery, malaria, what were some of the other ones? You know, infections, leprosy, scabies, those type things. And they were not seeing any of the modern diseases. Well, these same people in all these different areas of the world would see either, especially over a lifetime, they would see either white settlements move in, or they would typically, like if they were in a rural part of Africa, they may go work at a hospital in a city for a few years and then come back to the rural population. But what they would notice is those traditional people, once they moved to town, mm-hmm. just like Weston A. Price found, crooked teeth, mm-hmm. appendicitis, tons of gastrointestinal problems, constipation, mm-hmm. heart disease, obesity, almost instantly.
Yeah.
Just that next generation immediately picks it up.
Well, and I had read some studies on modern Japanese. You'll hear people talk all the time about how Japanese women don't suffer from breast cancer nearly as much as American women, which I think is changing. But anyway, a lot of traditional diet eating Japanese people will move over to the United States and then start to have exactly their same rates of different types of cancer, including breast cancer and heart disease and obesity too. It's really fascinating how you see, you know, a lot of the Asians who are very petite, small people come over to the United States, and all of a sudden, a lot of them are huge. You know, just like Americans.
Yeah, yeah. Which nixes the whole premise of, well, that's just genetics.
Right.
I mean, some people say, let's play the devil's advocate for a moment. They'll say, well, it's just genetics that they're not overweight, that they eat all that fat. Mm-hmm. Well, it's just genetics that they don't have heart disease. And we see it's quite the opposite. Yeah. The interesting thing is, and I, one of the populations that were in, I don't remember which part of Africa it is, South Africa, maybe. Let me look, I might find his name. Let's see. No. Anyway, I can't find it right now. I think it was one of the ones in Africa. He found that he worked with a very, very remote village, and they ate a very high-fat diet, just, you know, normal things that they had eaten for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years. And they saw a migration to the city, and I don't remember if they needed workers or what, but the government was trying to get people to migrate to the city. And what he found was they ate a very low-calorie diet in the city. They were poor. They lived off of mostly polished grains, you know, just the white grains, white rice, white flour. Mm-hmm. That was their ration. That was what was cheap. They ballooned. I mean, they were eating a 1,600-calorie diet a day, which by most places is nearly starving. And compared to their traditional diet, which had been lots of calories, very high-calorie diet. So their traditional diet is really, really high fat. And then they move to the city, and they're on a low-fat, high-carbohydrate, high-processed carbohydrate diet, and they ballooned on less calories. And then, of course, they have all the typical chronic diseases, heart disease, diabetes, and of course, all the gastrointestinal stuff along with it. But it's the same story with every researcher on every continent. And I mean, there are so many that made, and the ones I mentioned that made it their life work. I think W. Roger Williams was a big cancer guy, and he went to every continent and studied cancer and found out where they had high carbohydrate diets and they had sugar, there was cancer. Where they ate the high fat, the traditional foods, the nutrient-dense foods, they did not have cancer.
Now, so it seems so obvious that this is what we ought to do, is eat, you know, less refined carb. Why do you think that we have not implemented this in the United States?
Well, I think
she's putting on her dietitian hat.
I know. Or climbing up on my soapbox.
That's right.
you're familiar with Mr. Key's work.
Oh, yes.
Implementing the low-fat
diet. I forgot about Mr. Keyes. Yeah.
He had a hypothesis that saturated fat caused heart disease. And
because people with heart disease have plaque in their arteries. And they think it's made of cholesterol, which it sometimes is.
Right. And there's different theories about that, which we need to do a whole podcast on heart disease desperately. I mean, I think that should be next.
Yeah.
But anyway, he wanted to make it public policy that everyone needed a low saturated fat diet. And it became public policy in spite of some really, really bad research, which none of his research actually showed that saturated fat caused heart disease. But he sold it very well, and the media got on board, and that made good headlines.
He had a really pretty chart that he created.
And once you get the media on board, and you get the American population on board, you know, the media realized that headline was selling, and they took off with it. And that just gave it momentum to get all this passed before they could really research it. Mm-hmm. So they got it passed as public policy, and then they did some research, and they've been trying to prove it ever since. And it's just... And I remember thinking that in college, well, okay, I'm reading in the textbook that saturated fat causes heart disease, but there are so many studies out there that are still trying to prove it. If it's true, why are we still trying to prove it, number one? And number two, I remember reading multiple studies, well, results were inconclusive, but we still believe low-fat diet is the best. Or the results didn't show it this time, but we still believe that a low-saturated diet is best because we believe this was a fluke. Or, you know... Mm-hmm. But, I mean, looking back now, I think I read that a lot.
Yeah.
How many flukes can there be before it's evidence?
Yeah.
Which is the case, because there's actual mounds and mounds of evidence on the fat, on the side of saturated fat does not cause heart disease. Mm-hmm. But anyway, that's a whole different subject. But one of the, I mean, it is important to look at the characteristics. If you want to be healthy, you study healthy people. Mm-hmm. If you want to be unhealthy, you study unhealthy people. Mm-hmm. And so when you look around the world and look at healthy people, they're eating saturated fat.
Don't study us.
Don't study Americans. I mean, right. If you want to be healthy, don't look at Americans. Mm-hmm. We know we're, I mean, last time I checked, do you know what we rank in world health? I mean, last time we were in the 30s.
Last. We're last among, not last place, but we're one of the last countries in the, of the developed countries.
Yes, we were in the 30s last I looked.
Out of like 40, I think.
Yeah.
I mean, it's low. Like,
and I was thinking it was 37. But yeah. I don't remember that to be fact, but we were low, I know that.
Yeah.
So don't look at us. But if you want to be healthy, study healthy people. And it's interesting that the one thing, so many researchers have done this and made this their life work, and they've lived in these populations, so if there were cancer, they would have seen it. I mean, it's not a lack of diagnostic tools. Doctors were there evaluating for long periods of time. It's not a lack of genetics, because we've seen them that move to different areas, and or not a lack, but not because of genetics, because we've seen them move to other areas, and they're good. But the one thing they all have in common, the interesting thing is they eat different foods. Like, I think you said that too. Some are eating more dairy. Some are eating less dairy. Some are eating
a lot of vegetables. Some eat hardly at all.
Some, like the Eskimos, have very limited. Yeah. I mean, just...
It's like
there's no growing.
The one month out of the year that you might find a barrier to.
There's a small growing season, so they're eating a lot less. Some they're living off of pure lard or blubber up there. Other areas down south are living off of pure coconuts. Mm-hmm. So their diets vary, but the one thing in common was the lack of access to modern foods. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of, especially dietitians are typically type A, very anal people, and they want a number. They want to know, how many grams of protein is that? How many grams of saturated fat? Well, how much fiber is that? We need to nail this down, and we need the biochemistry of it down. And it's so, it gets to a point where it's like, you know, it's food. It's simple. The one thing they have in common, that I mean, the varying amount, there were varying amounts of protein, although they all had it in saturated fat forms, varying amounts of fat. The one thing is, they all had an absence of modern foods.
Yes.
They didn't have health foods. Mm-hmm. They didn't have any of the things.
Tofurkey.
They didn't have tofurkey. They're all on real, wholesome food. Mm-hmm. And so I think we can get hung up and overwhelmed in the details, especially as practitioners and health providers and especially dietitians. Oh, gosh, we are terrible about that. I mean, we just are. We are. It's really, I feel like it's so much simpler than that. The gist of the information is just get off any modern food whatsoever.
But it's so hard to do, because it's just like, oh, I love French fries. I love, you know, apple pie and all these different... You can make your own.
Right.
But it's so nice just to go out and have, you know, some Bluebell ice cream. And I mean, it's just, it's so almost addictive. And
well, and this is where real life comes in.
Yeah.
I have, Jerrica has a one-year-old. I have a one-year-old, but I also have a six-year-old. And she's been in kindergarten this year. And up until this point, she had been at home with me. And my friends make fun of me because they've seen me in the grocery store. Her ask what these strange colored boxes of with bright colors in them, a.k.a. children's breakfast cereal, what is that? And I'm like, well, honey, that is man-made junk that they have marketed to us as food, but it's not really food, it's poison. And my friends would laugh at me, but that's been her perspective. And we have eaten, I mean, just really good, rich, nutritious foods. Well, you know, you eventually lose control of that with your child.
She leaves the bubble.
She leaves the bubble. And anyway, and she wasn't totally protected. I mean, they've given their Cheetos at church. And sometimes at church they give marshmallows as a snack and then send them in to sit with us in the church service, which is, you know, something's got to be done about that. Lauren, if you're listening. like, what do I do with her now? But anyway, you know, so, and that's not a big deal to me that she has that every now and then. I think that's... because she's not getting at home, and it's not 90% of her diet, but she is getting more influence at school.
And it starts to be weird, like, why don't you eat marshmallows, you know?
Yeah, in which, you know, Savannah's just, she's asked questions like, did their mommies not love them? They send them Lunchables. And I'm
like, well, first of all, we need to create.
Call CPS. There's Lunchables on the table.
I'm like, first of all, we're going to teach when to speak and when not to speak, because we don't want to judge others. And, right. you know, it's not a matter of their mom not loving them.
She walks up to her 6-year-old boy and she says, don't eat that. It's poison.
We're teaching when to hold her tongue and when it is, you know. And we're definitely teaching her that. But it's raised a lot of questions. Mm-hmm. And just being in school, the amount of candy and stuff mm-hmm. that gets sent home, or they feed them goldfish and other things mm-hmm. at school, which most parents are like, oh, I'm so glad they feed them goldfish instead of cookies or something.
Yeah, it has real cheese in it, you know, whatever.
And I'm like, well, you know, we could actually take this another way and, you know, take it down another step. But That's where the real life sets in. It's very hard to get mm-hmm. away from all processed foods. And we just try to do it as much as possible mm-hmm. at home so that she is 100% healthy and her body is prepared to deal with whatever else she gets mm-hmm. from outside sources.
And I think it's important not to, like, force your kids to eat really gross, weird stuff and, you know, make it embarrassing or difficult in front of their friends, because you want them, you know, even if they stray for a little while and go on their cheeseburger binges and stuff, you know, you want them to eventually return to healthy foods, real foods, because they like the taste and it makes them feel good, and they know, you know, they somehow know that it's good for them. That's really valid.
And I can see that in Savannah. For the longest time, we would never order off a children's menu because there's just junk on children's menus at restaurants. Here's half a bowl of macaroni with a side of French fries. I mean, mm-hmm. that's kind of what you get at restaurants. And so she would usually just share with us. And then eventually she said, well, I want to order something myself, which sometimes she does order adult entrees. But she started wanting that. Like, I want to try that because it has a cartoon beside it. And then she would eat ours. She would eat our real food instead of the junk food. Kids, you know, yeah. And I'm like, oh, now I have to pay for this junk, and we're not eating it. But so I think they have that basis that they taste real food and they recognize it and they want it.
Definitely.
And I do think even though they may want to try those other things, that foundation is there and mm-hmm. they'll come back to it.
And we've got our various forms of quote unquote health insurance. You know, like the cod liver oil is really, you know, kind of tends to negate some of the nutrient lacking in modern foods, because unfortunately modern soils are very depleted of nutrients, and so whether you're raising animals or crops on them, you're going to have a hard time getting as much nutrients as there were 150 years ago on the same soil. I've read, you know, a couple of resources where, you know, a modern peach or a modern ear of corn has like 1/50th. In other words, you'd have to eat 50 ears of corn to get the same nutrients as the one that you could have gotten, you know, 100 years ago.
The USDA I don't know if it's the USDA or the FDA, has documented that, and you can mm-hmm. see broccoli here, broccoli there, you know, through the years, and on the chart, it's just going down, 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 down.
And the reason for that, it's not just a phenomenon, it's actually because we have been over-farming our soils for so many years and not putting compost, not putting, you know, animal manures back in, that eventually, you know, all the good stuff in the soil just erodes and washes basically down into the Gulf of Mexico. So it's all in the ocean now. So we're trying to build back up our topsoil, build back up our organic matter so we have nutrients in the soil, but it takes a long time.
Yeah, a lot of healing needs to happen for that. Well, we are out of time for today. Jerrica, do you have anything last you want to add?
Well, I guess, you know, I just encourage you, if you're interested in the Weston Price Foundation, they have a lot of really, really good and free resources online. They have basically all of their articles they ever publish on their website. It's at westonaprice.org. That's W-E-S-T-O-N. It's Weston with an O. aprice.org. And they have, you know, articles and resources and things that you can print out. Or just read online with the characteristics of healthy diets. And, you know, it's really actually quite liberating, because you hear all the time, well, don't eat fat, don't eat salt, don't eat butter, don't eat this, don't eat that. And you can start to eat things that taste good again. Not, you know, you don't have to get stuck just eating rice cakes that taste like cardboard with a little sugar on top. You know, it was always so liberating for us, because it's like, I can eat bacon and sausage and eggs for breakfast all in the same meal, and that's okay. Now, you know, they explain the difference between, like, conventional, you know, very processed bacon and pasture-raised, chemical-free bacon. But it actually is very liberating to be able to eat real food again, because it tastes better. So many people have been disappointed because their doctor says, well, you better stop eating butter and you better stop drinking whole milk because your heart is going to, you know, it's going to have all these problems. Let's put you on this drug. And so they end up drinking, you know, skim milk or almond milk, and they don't really like it, but they do it because they think they're going to be unhealthy if not.
Yeah.
So it's actually quite, you know, exciting and freeing to be able to eat real stuff again.
Real food, yeah. Yes, to be able to actually eat real fruit instead of Frankenfood. Mm-hmm. It's very appetizing.
Yes, it's quite tasty.
Quite tasty. I agree. All right, well, with that, we'll wrap up the show. Remember, we want to hear from you. We love to hear feedback from the show. If you have an idea for a show that we need to do, a podcast that we need to do, a topic we need to cover, please let us know what you're interested in hearing about. Also, if you have any questions that you would like us to answer in a podcast, or if you want it answered off air, that's okay too. Or if you want your name left off, that's fine. But be sure to contact us. Our email is questions@eatingthegoodlifewithchristinapetite.com. And that's petite, PETEETE.com. And be sure to leave us some feedback. We'd love to hear from you.
Thanks for listening.